It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Here on Declare Your Independence, with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Central Standard Time on Republic Broadcasting Network from FreedomsPhoenix.com studios here in BEA, beautiful Phoenix, Arizona. Now, I know what you guys want to talk about, all the coverage all over about, you know, the man with an AR-15 in Phoenix, and it went really well. I mean, we've getting the message out and what we wanted to accomplish, and it's still going. I did CNN. I've done all local affiliates. I had MSNBC want me to go on this morning, but I... No. You know why? We got our message out. We're good. And I knew it. They're just, no, never mind. It's all good. Now, what happened is there's something even more important that I want to talk to you about. And if you want to know about this issue, you go to freedomsphoenix.com, freedoms with an S, phoenix.com, and you'll see the archive for this show. If you go into that show, at the bottom of the page, we have all the links to all the video coverage. Even made the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. You know, I can die now. You know, Jon Stewart, he's the man. He's kind of left and, you know, whatever. But I keep hitting the microphone. Yeah, but he's, you know, man, if it wasn't for him, I'd gone insane a long time ago. I mean, especially during the Bush administration. And he'll come around, you know, he always does. But it's been a really good message. But it's all incorporated into the bank robbery, because the message was this. Now, I wanted to demonstrate that the Phoenix Police Department still protecting our rights, and because we've worked with them in the past, and, you know, it was a good stunt, you know, a publicity stunt. That's what we, but the publicity was not for anything other than Phoenix Police Department protects our rights. That was the message from the beginning. They knew it, and they worked with us, helped us with this. It went out fine. Now, Chris, that came with the AR-15, he had a more stern message. He represents a generation. He's 28 years old, and his, you know, and the fact that he's black had, you know, a lot to do with it more than he realized, you know, because you're dealing with other generations, you know, that have other stereotypes. His generation is just not an issue. Race is, you know, evaporated as an issue, and the bad guys hate that. They want you separated. They want you divided so you can be conquered. Well, his thing, he's a member of the John Birch Society. Heck, I remember going to an event where he introduced the head of the John Birch Society, and we went because he was doing that. It was, you know, show of support. He's a revolutionary. He's a good friend. And so we went all down there, you know, sat there for 90 minutes and then went out to dinner. And he introduced the head of the John Birch Society. I'm like, what up with that? Because he's very conservative. He's a pro-life, Christian, conservative constitution guy. And the message was this. If you continue to plunder my generation, the younger people coming of age now, to the point that there is nothing left, if you keep doing this and pile on this debt that is being that benefits a generation that will be long dead and gone and don't have to pay this debt on their shoulders, sooner or later there will be resistance, even armed resistance. He was very clear about that. And I'm going, you know, that's a, you know, that's the truth. I mean, that's, you know, we know that's eventually what's going to happen. Now, I want, that's why it's so important we have this conversation today with Suzanne Trimbath. Suzanne is a PhD, okay? She worked, her training was in finance and economics, began with editing the briefing documents for the Economic Research Department of the Federal Reserve in San Francisco. She is going to tell us exactly how we were robbed. This is a, it's going to be a great show, and it's a, you know, segue from Bud Burrell's revelations, and he was the one who introduced me to Suzanne. It's going to be a great resource for you to listen to over and over. We'll be right back on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Suzanne Trimbath.
There are those that just want to be left alone, and those that just won't leave them alone. Which one are you? The Ernest Hancock Show.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock from BEA, beautiful Phoenix, Arizona. Now, online, we have Suzanne Trimbath. Do I have you there, Suzanne?
Yes, I'm right here, Ernest.
Suzanne, the one thing that I want to start off from the very beginning so we have an understanding, and you got your PhD from New York University, where you've taught also economics and finance. You've taught at the University of Southern California, Marshall School of Business. So you've co-authored books. You got some skills. Now, the thing is that your training in finance and economics, beginning with editing briefing documents for the Economic Research Department of the Federal Reserve in San Francisco, you had to have been initially, at least, in the mindset that, you know, there are dials on panels that you can turn and kind of, you know, fix or do or change or alter the course of economics in America, and that's a good or bad thing. And I'm wondering how, by doing that, what perspective it gave you. Can you do that? Should we do that? How is it being abused? Let's start there.
Yeah, I was there at a really interesting time. It was the early 1980s. And I was actually editing briefing documents for use by the bank president, which was John Ballas at that time, in the meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee, and he was a voting member there. And at that
time, let's define each one of these things. That's why when you say Federal Market Committee,
Federal Open Market Committee,
all right, what does that mean?
And that's the policy setting group. Whenever you hear, you know, these information comes out, the Fed is going to raise interest rates or lower interest rates or these things, that's the group that makes those decisions.
Okay, which is the head of each one of the regional Federal Reserve banks, and they kind of come together under, you know, whoever the guy is today, you know, Bernanke, and they sit around and they, you know, talk about which senator, congressman, or presidential candidate called them, and they're going to decide what they're going to do, right?
Right, and they set this monetary policy. And so the time that I was at the Fed in San Francisco was a turning point in monetary policy, where they went from trying to control the interest rates to trying to control the money supply. And so they would, instead of setting a target for, well, we want the interest rates to be, you know, 3%, they would say, well, we want the money supply to grow by 2%. And it was interesting to be there at that point because, of course, I was still new to economics. I was learning a lot as I was there. But what I found was that they kept moving the target to, like, the target chased the money supply instead of the other way around. And it just seemed that there weren't – it seemed very difficult for them to control the money supply. And, in fact, they – later in that decade, abandoned the policy of trying to control the money supply and went back to setting interest rates as a tool for monetary policy.
Okay, now why do you think they did that? What was the difference? Because one affects the other, supposedly.
Right, so, supposedly, right. But because I think they abandoned it because it simply didn't work. If you remember what happened in the 1980s, you had, you had interest rates. When the Federal Reserve let go of interest rates in the early 1980s, you had 30-year Treasury bonds paying 18%.
No, I remember. I bought my first car then, and, you know, 20-something percent on a interest rate back then was...
You were on the wrong side. I scraped together every dime I could find to buy one 7-year Treasury bond that paid 14%. And I know, and I had neighbors who were borrowing against their life insurance policies to buy Treasury bills because you could borrow against your life insurance policy for 3%. You get 18% on government bonds.
Mm-mm-mm. So, now why did they all of a sudden they're deciding, okay, we're going to do this money supply thing as opposed to setting target interest rates?
Right.
And I thought they were kind of connected, but they decided that they needed, was it a bigger dial, a smaller dial? They're going to have this dial about money supply.
Right.
They are doing that for a reason. And the reason was, is they what? They wanted to sell more treasuries? I mean, what was it they were trying to do?
No, it seemed to me at that point in time, remember, we were just coming out of the 70s. We had stagflation, stagnant economy with high inflation rates. Generally seemed that monetary policy was not working. The way they were trying to established monetary policy simply it just wasn't working.
Okay, so it wasn't working then. Now we've gone back to what wasn't working, right?
Now we went back to, yes. In fact, we did go back to what wasn't working.
Okay, so they tried this and it didn't work either.
Right.
So this is my question. As someone that was there during this, trying two ways of dial turning, okay?
Right.
Can you ever make it work? Can you have a central plan for the economy run by some central bank? I mean, is that possible?
You see, at that point in time, of course, I have a lot more economic training now than I did back then. But back then, it just seemed to me, I mean...
You were doing
really
the best you could.
It wasn't working.
You were doing the best you could. This is the dial they put in front of me. Let's do what we can.
Yeah, I think that they did. I think that they, like I said, they saw that one way wasn't working. They tried another way. That was such a dismal failure that they, you know, unofficially reverted back to the other policy of
another failure.
Setting interest rates. and that, well, the thing is that it has the whether or not monetary policy, in my opinion, whether or not monetary policy works in this country and how well it works has a lot to do with how it's presented. This is one thing that Greenspan did very, very well, and that was he knew what to say so that the markets and consumers would behave in ways that were productive for monetary policy.
Oh, yeah, okay? He had good rhetoric. That libertarian kind of thing was eking in there. He could say the right thing just like Reagan did,
right.
But that's not what they did.
Right, exactly. It didn't matter what they did. It was what they said because that's what people reacted to. And I think what we're seeing now is that I don't think that Bernanke has quite that same skill.
Well, it doesn't matter. It's because of the Internet. Everybody knows whatever he says would be a lie anyway.
Well, this is true also. I mean, the rapidity with which information moves at this point and the accessibility of information and data, actual facts and figures, compared to 20 years ago. I mean, come on.
I'll give you a good example. I want to get your comment on this. It was Dr. Paul is talking to Bernanke, and he's going, look, you're not going to monetize the debt, are you? While he's sitting there, they were doing it, and he's saying, no, we would never do that. Boom, he must have hit his BlackBerry and said, do it. So, you know, they can't get away with this stuff anymore. So we're in a situation, and this is where you have a unique perspective. You were inside during all this, learning how it's being done, trying, doing the best you can to turn the dials the right way to we all be better off. But what I want to understand is, okay, they tried to do controlling money supply. That didn't work because, you know, it's got its own, you know, political just games. You can't centrally plan an economy. It just can't and have a free market. That's my opinion. So right. I don't care what you do. It's not going to work. But so you're very experienced in two different ways. You're going to control interest rates. You're going to control money supply. It didn't work. So now we're going into your next posting was what?
Then I went to the it was with the Pacific Stock Exchange. I worked in the Securities Depository Trust Company and the Clearing Corporation for the Pacific Stock Exchange.
Oh, I want to talk about this. Now.
So now I kind of went to the other side, if you will.
Well, tell me what that other side is. Now, you go ahead and say this again and define, because I've read a bunch of the stuff on this, and I'm still not getting how it really worked. Now, what they say in law and they put on pieces of paper don't mean nothing, okay?
So
when you go to the Depository Trust Company, that's what you were at, right?
Well, I went to the Pacific Depository Trust Company first and then to the Depository Trust Company in New York.
Okay.
Depository
Trust
right.
is what?
Okay. We have in order to clear and settle trades. In other words, when you tell your broker buy some shares from me of IBM, the broker executes that on some exchange, and then that transaction, both sides, buyer and seller of that transaction, have to enter that information into a central system. And that central system is where depository trust companies and clearing corporations come into play.
Okay, now, depository trust companies, are they public, private, a combination? What are they?
Private.
Okay,
they're all private companies.
Okay,
they
now
are,
I'm linked to what?
They're formed like cooperatives. So you have it's owned by the users. So,
okay, do they have competition? Are there more than one for this kind of thing?
No, sir, there's not.
No, there's not. Why is there not? Why is there not?
There was a point in time in the late 80s, early 90s, where the finance ministers and central bankers from 30 countries got together and came to an agreement that there should be one depository and one clearing corporation in each country.
Okay, now so they came to an agreement. Now, this agreement had the force of law? Are they looking for the Senate to pass it, or they just mandated it from on high? Because what if Ernie wants to do, you know, I want to do my depository trust company. I'm going to open it tomorrow. Right. I can't because why?
I don't know that there's any law that would stop you from doing that. But the problem here is going to be that all of this stuff is electronic. And so he who has the biggest computers can charge the lowest rate. And the barrier to entry for you right now into that monopoly is probably more of scale, a matter of scale than anything else.
Well, I don't have to have it. I can start Ernie's Stock Exchange. I mean, you know, I can do it. I can do whatever I want, you know. But the thing is, now let's say
you would have to be registered with the Securities and Exchange
Commission. Oh, there we go. We get government in there somewhere. Okay, so
yes, of course.
So what happens is that we have this depository trust company that they are taking the actual possession of the stocks and initial public offerings or something? Is that what's happening?
Let's just back up a little bit so we'll know exactly what we're talking about when we talk about the Depository Trust Company. Up until about 1970, whenever a stock's traded, the money and the shares had to change hands one for one.
So okay, now wait a minute. We're going to the break. I know you're getting into the meat of it.
Okay, yeah.
And we're
going to
hold off till after the break because people will stay there because they know. Here we go into the meat of how the robbery took place. You guys need to know this because this is how it's going. You'll be playing this over and over. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, and Suzanne Trimbath. Going to explain everything just a little bit.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Mine. It's all mine. All your chips on the table. This is Ernest Hancock on Declare Your Independence. Me, Ernest Hancock, and we have Suzanne Trimbath. You know, and what happened, all your chips in. Everything on the table. You got pension funds in there. We got you socially and economically engineered. We have, you know, all the 401ks and all your retirement funds and the money market. And we got that forced income tax. That's semi-voluntary. And then you have Social Security, Medicare. You got all these big, giant buckets of money, and they're on there. And now what they say, they go, it's all ours now. Thank you for playing. And then the stock market goes up, you know, it's 9,400, and we're going to put more in. And it triggers some AAA kind of great and wonderful. It's time to put the money back in. And all these fund managers and everything put the money back on the table again. And then they rake it off, all the chips off the table, and they go, that's ours too. Thank you for playing. And we'll do it again if we can get away with it. How did they get away with it? Well, that's what we're talking to Suzanne Trimbath about. Now, she's got up to the point to where the depository trust companies are set up as clearinghouses for stocks that come in and they, you know, distribute them. There's a guy that bought it and there's a guy that sold it and we're keeping track of it. Now, she's explaining this to us. Suzanne, please continue.
Right. So up until about 1970, when a company issued stock, they actually issued pieces of paper and gave them to individuals and broker-dealers who purchased the shares from them.
And then somebody actually carry it over to them and pieces of paper.
They would all meet at some, you know, location near Wall Street, or they would have them delivered, hand-delivered from one, you know, from the point where they were issued. So each issuer would have an agent, and that agent would have an office near Wall Street.
Actually paper, man. Those old 10-speed bicycles were busy boys.
And they would get checks. They would take checks as payment, and this was the process. Well, the volume of activity, you know, in the 1960s, households started increasing their investment in stocks in publicly owned companies. And so the volume of trades became so high that the broker-dealers, transfer agents, and companies were unable to move the checks and the paper certificates around fast enough in order to meet, at that point, I think it was like a five-day clearing and settlement.
Hire more people. Get more little 10-speed bicycles.
What they decided to do.
I know what they decided to do.
Centralize. So the New York Stock Exchange opened a department called Central Depository or Certificate Depository, and all the certificates were then dropped off and left out. Like any broker, just like you could put your money in a bank, a broker could put his stocks into the Central Depository. And then they wouldn't have to deliver certificates. They could have things moved around electronically.
Okay. Now, this was a crucial turning point here.
Very, very important, because this is the point where CD & Co. comes into existence.
Okay, now explain. Let me go ahead and explain this. I want to make sure people understand. This is when it happened. Now you're talking what? Late '60s.
Late '60s, right?
In the late '60s, it used to be I purchased stock in a company. I bought so much GM, IBM, whatever M. Okay, I go in there and I say I want this. I buy the stock. That the reconciliation starts then, and they had a time limit. It had to be done within 3 days or something, or did they have
5 days?
Within 5 days. And they filled it up. They got within 5 days. They have someone that will reconcile this. They go, okay, we got so many people buying this, and we're going to take it over to this guy, and you know, and reconcile their books. Okay, how
pick
many
up
this
the money.
Now pick up? They'll get the money. It goes here. We take the stock, physical pieces of paper, and
right.
they go in and they say, here you go. Because
right.
the reason
Which,
that
you
they
have to
did
change
that
the ownership on that piece of paper, Ernest, from. You know, Merrill Lynch to Ernest Hancock.
Yeah, no, which is exactly what they should do, because what happens is, just like happened in the 29 stock crash back then, and all was going on then was counterfeiting of the paper. So now they're saying, we got to keep track on no counterfeiting, and they still have paper. So then they decide, oh, it's just so busy, we just can't, oh, heavens, Murgatroyd, we got to have electronic and do this by computer, so it's a lot easier to counterfeit.
And also, at that point in time, one of the reasons why they thought going electronic would help is that after the shares were sold, the broker was unable to deliver the shares on time, so they would fail to deliver for settlement. So that was one of the main reasons that...
No, that was the main reason they created. They just hire more kids with bicycles.
To stop the fails to deliver.
No, they created the fails to deliver. I guarantee it. If they had free market capitalism, you want to deliver little pieces of paper. You know, that's what you got Federal Express for, okay? So this is... Was it possible for them to deliver the paper if that was their goal? That's all I want to know. Was it physically possible?
No, at that point, in 1969, it was physically impossible to do it because, Ernest, it wasn't just delivering the paper. It was getting the paper re-registered from one name to the next.
Okay, so they decided that it was physically impossible, so we're going to go to Little Electrons, and we're going to do it that way. So they made that decision. How did they implement it?
Right, so the New York Stock Exchange had a department called Certificate Depository, the initial CD, which is where CD & Co., CED & Co. comes from. CD & Co. is the nominee name. So when the shares were dropped off at the New York Stock Exchange, they were re-registered for CD & Co., meaning the New York Stock Exchange doesn't own them, but the New York Stock Exchange is holding them for someone else. So they're holding it in name only, nominee. They're holding it in name only, but they're assigning the ownership rights to the broker-dealer members who were putting them on deposit.
Okay, so it's like you're doing business with somebody that has the same bank as you. You're going to Bank of America, yeah. Chase, whatever, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. have, you know, $100 cash in there, and they're going, this is your $100. Oh, no, not yours anymore. It's this guy's over here. It's in his account on the electronic sheet, right?
Right. They just keep thousands of dollars in the vault, and whoever comes in gets the first one off the stack of $100 bills when you come in to get your cash. And it is very much like doing business at the same bank because, you know, if you take a check to the bank that it's drawn on, you can get money right away.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and we'll talk about it more when we come back. They're going to push the button on us, Suzanne. It's going fast, isn't it? We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence with Suzanne Trimbath and Ernest Hancock in just a little bit.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Saddle again and declare your independence of me, Ernest Hancock, and my very special guest, Suzanne Trimbath, that's explaining things to us. This is information you need to know. Now, where we left off, I believe, is the New York Deposit Trust Corporation. They have an account. They're a bank. We're going in, and I'm saying, all right, we got on deposit there some stocks, you know, the money, whatever. It's a stock from a company that decided that by law, by New York stock exchange says you had to, whatever. It's sitting there, and then they're transferring ownership without actually moving the paper between people that buy and sell it. Now, the ability for them to be the depository for this, how did that come about that everybody had to be in agreement that was going to happen?
No, and so to move forward from 1969 up to 1975, you now have separate corporations separated from the New York Stock Exchange. You have the Depository Trust Company, which is holding all the certificates, and you have the National Securities Clearing Corporation, which is performing the trade reconciliation, post-trade reconciliation.
And wait. Okay, let's define the difference between those two. Somebody that's actually taken the piece of paper and putting it somewhere.
Right.
Okay, and then there's a
trust company.
Okay, now then there's somebody else actually takes and decides ownership of that paper?
Yes, they reconcile the trades. So
why is it if somebody's holding my money? I'm thinking I want them to keep track of who owns it.
Yeah, what was happening was trades were settling one by one. So if Merrill did a trade with Lehman, that trade settled in IBM, that trade settled, and then if Merrill did a trade with another broker, that trade in IBM, that trade settled separately. And what they tried to do then was to sort of speed up the process so that if Merrill bought 100 shares of IBM and sold 100 shares of IBM, they were net zero change in position for the day. And so that's why they created this clearing corporation. And what the clearing corporation basically does is just when a buy and a sell trades meet, when they agree on the exchange to buy and to sell, both parties enter that data into the system, and the clearing corporation verifies that they've met all the terms agree. That Merrill didn't say it was 101 shares, and Shearson said it was 102 shares.
Got
to
it.
Sure,
okay.
That's all corrected.
Okay. So let's go ahead and I apologize. We've got 2 hours. We're going to make sure we get through it. So don't worry about it. Let me ask this question. I want to make sure I make this clear, because this is for me just as much as the audience. Now, what I want to understand is that now they're looking at a balance sheet at the end of the day that says that because you have trade millions of trades going back and forth, okay, tens of millions. So it's going boom, 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 boom. And at the end of the day, they're going, okay, this Excel spreadsheet, for lack of a better analogy, you go, here's this Excel spreadsheet. At the end of this spreadsheet, Merrill Lynch on this specific stock bought and sold X amount of these stocks, and whatever the dollar amount is somebody else's problem. I just need to know how many I got to sign over to them.
Well, no, they do care about the clearing corporation now is also involved in the money settlement. So they're reconciling the money as well. The only difference between the money side and the stock side is that these Depository Trust Company and the clearing corporation don't hold money. They only hold shares. Right. But they do come up at that balance sheet at the end of the day says, we owe you 100 shares of IBM and 20 shares of Microsoft, and you owe us $3,000, for example.
All right.
The difference is that the clearing corporation can send a message to the depository that says, move these positions electronically on your books of the stocks. But then the other message they send is, go to the bank and collect this money from that broker as well.
Okay, now, so that's why you have the two-level system. These guys reconcile it. These people over here are actually putting who owns what and where money could collect.
Mm-hmm. And the money side, of course, has to go through the banking system, and that's where the Depository Trust Company is a member of the Federal Reserve System.
Okay. Oh, now see, that's now we have the Depository Trust Company. Now we're getting into a third thing or fourth thing here. We have the people that actually have the piece of paper. We have the other group that is determining the reconciliation of who owns that paper and for how much. Then it tells them, okay, now transfer it over here through the banking system, and the Federal Reserve gets involved where?
For the money movements.
Okay, why federal? Where'd they come in this thing?
Well, because the Depository Trust Company, neither the Depository Trust Company nor the National Securities Clearing Corporation are depository institutions. Are banks? Neither one of them is a bank that holds money.
So you're not using private banks here or Fred's back pocket or anything. It has to be a Federal Reserve Bank that's involved in this transaction.
Yeah, I mean, up until. It actually was individual banks up until about 1993. Between 93 and 96, They switched it over to electronic funds transfer, which means it was going through the Federal Reserve. But prior to that, the broker dealers had to have banks drawn on, had to have a check drawn on a New York City clearinghouse bank, and they would deliver that check to the National Securities Clearing Corporation for settlement.
Okay, now so I can see we keep getting more and more collective. You can see my concern here. I can see what's happening.
Yes, of course.
You know, they're consolidating
the more, the more electronic it becomes, the easier it should be to reconcile, but the sloppier the reconciliation gets in reality.
Wow, this is – okay, so now we're understanding so that we can walk this through. We have an initial public offering by, you know, Fred's company goes public, and he takes a stock and he puts it with a depository trust company that holds it in there and assigns ownership and collects money to pay off whatever. The reconciliation of the trades is another group called –
National Securities Clearing Corporation.
So National Securities Clearing Corporation says, okay, here's what they owe, and they're, you know, send an email and go, okay, now assign this and do whatever. And now it's transferred into a bank. You know, the balance of money goes somewhere. So you have the money going through a Federal Reserve Bank, you know, or a Federal Reserve affiliated bank, and you have that done. Okay, now where do we go from there?
Well, these institutions first initiated in the mid-70s, there were depository trust companies and clearing corporations in several cities around the country. And it wasn't until about 1990 that we ended up with one and only one, and that became the monopoly in New York, which is Depository Trust Company and the National Securities Clearing Corporation. The reason that I kind of emphasized why they started was because there were the fails to deliver in trade settlements. So it was impossible to deliver securities on time for settlements. This is one of the reasons why they were created. But even after the electronic settlement went into place, they were still unable to get securities delivered on time. And
why?
At this point, there's no excuse. The excuse in the 70s was, well, I couldn't get the certificate there. I had to get it transferred. There was a problem with the signature, all this paperwork, right? But now the paperwork reason is removed, and yet this system continues to tolerate the failure to deliver securities for settlement.
Okay, now let's talk about this in layman terms.
Mm-hmm.
Failure to deliver securities for settlement means that name on that electronic name that's in that piece of paper at the depository trust company, they are saying, okay, take and move this piece, you know, change the electrons here to say this guy, to say Fred to Steve, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then they're not doing that for days because?
Because the broker-dealer sold more than they owned.
Oh, so and now we're getting into naked short selling.
Right. Now it's just as simple as that. The excuse, the rationale, it wasn't so much that they were counterfeiting paper.
They're counterfeiting electrons.
1970, it's just that they were not reconciling the ownership.
They were check kiting.
You would have more than one owner for each share.
They were check kiting.
Right. It's very much like that. That's a very good parallel with check kiting.
Okay. So they're writing checks and hoping it takes a while longer and there might be some stocks available and later and it'll balance out and we can get away with this because there's no penalty.
There's no penalty. And that's exactly the problem, is that there's no real penalty for any of this. Let me just tell you that in 2004, the Securities and Exchange Commission tried to put some rules in place because there was this big uproar about naked short selling. And at that point in time, there were about $3 billion worth of stocks that failed to deliver in time for settlement at the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation.
Okay, $3 billion.
About $3 billion.
That's chump change. It's a lot more than that now, isn't it?
Well, in March of 2009, the latest data that we have, on a peak day, there were $6 billion worth of shares failed to deliver. Now, you're right. This is chump change, but we're talking about equities. If we move into the bond side, then the numbers are more like $600
billion. Wow. Okay.
But the problem, Ernest, is not so much that it's $3 billion or $6 billion. The exact value isn't the problem. The problem is that if it's $6 billion today, it can be $6 trillion tomorrow because there's no penalty and there's nothing to stop it. The other thing is that it's $6 billion every day. So that $6 billion could have been undelivered for months, in some cases for a year. And yet no penalty, no imposition of any sanctions on anyone. It's just that those there were more shares sold than existed, and yet no one is doing the reconciliation.
Now, if you're
despite the fact that the whole point of creating these central organizations was to improve reconciliation.
Well, what, all of a sudden you're realizing government lies? I mean, this is like a,
they're not government. They're privately owned.
Yeah.
They're owned by the users.
And those people are who?
The banks and the brokers.
And
well,
who
at this
owned,
point, they're all banks. There aren't any brokers left. They're all banks.
And who owns Washington, D.C. now?
Oh, yeah.
That's all the same people, man. You know, it's not that hard to understand. You know, it's why do you rob banks? Because that's where the money is. So why do banks rob, from us? Because that's where the money is. So
the first time a law firm approached me and said that they wanted to consider pursuing some litigation for these problems with naked short selling and fails to deliver, I told them, I said, you have to remember one thing before you step into that arena. The guys on the other side, they have all the money. They don't just have a lot of money, like deep pockets. They have all the money because they have your money and your 401k and your mother's Social Security. They have all the money.
Unlimited resources.
Right.
Unlimited in every aspect. They got their little, fly-sized nanobots flying around unlimited money. I mean, if they can, they are, okay? So I'm going, all right. So now we have electronified everything. They got it all to where it's supposedly, the ability to instantaneously settle all these things. They're not. Then you go, okay, well, why not? And that's because they don't have to, because there's no law saying they can't. Now, I have a close friend that trades in large sums of money. And I mean, large sums of money. So he goes in, he knows, short selling, naked short selling, you pay a premium. If they don't actually have it, it's kind of this quasi gray area to where you'll go in and you'll pay an extra fee on top of what the actual stock would be, to sell it short. Because if you know something's going to happen, if you're like, man, this just isn't going to, now this is going to go down. I want to buy this stock. How much stock is that? There isn't? Well, heck, I'll just buy, I'll naked short it. I'll pay extra to be able to short a stock. And his argument is that keeps the stock market more honest. It doesn't let them manipulate it as much when you got people out there knowing it's going to go down. Then the government comes out and, yeah, it's going. There it goes. All these guys are going to make a bunch of money. And they go, you're stopping naked short sale. And we froze. You can't do that anymore, except for our buddies over here at Merrill or Goldman. They can do it.
Well, actually, the thing that's so interesting about that is that despite all of the clamor against fails to deliver naked short selling, there was no hard and fast rule that it could not be done until last September, when the banks, someone started shorting bank stocks, and all of a sudden those banks, they put in an emergency order and said no one's allowed to short sell these bank stocks. But the interesting thing is that the banks were the ones that were doing the shorting.
Yeah, and some of the banks continued to short through little sweetheart deals. Only some people got away with it, where others couldn't, they could benefit on their own stock declining.
Well, here's something even more interesting, and here's a direction I want to move you in a little bit, if I can. And
please.
That is that at the point where the Securities and Exchange Commission put in the emergency order that you could not short the shares of more than 1,000 financial companies, some of those stocks had not had fails to deliver in their shares prior to the rule going in, but they did after the rule went in. In other words, if you can't short, you can fail. And the end result in terms of from the seller's point of view, there's no difference in the end result, which is that you sell shares and get money, except that if you fail to deliver, you don't incur those extra premium costs of short selling. You don't incur the extra cost of borrowing shares, but yet you're able to sell the shares anyway. You just don't deliver them for settlement, and there's no penalty.
Now I semi understood. I semi understood what you just said, but we need to clarify
that. Yeah, this is a very important point because it's the only difference between a naked short sell and a fail to deliver is whether or not you mark the trade short.
Okay, now what you're saying in essence, correct me if I'm wrong. If I do a naked short sale and I don't actually take delivery of it and I sell my position, somebody else gets it or whatever, I don't have a lot of the charges that go along with me actually taking possession.
No, you're selling, okay? And if you're selling the shares, then a short sell is when you sell shares that you don't own.
Right.
A legitimate short sale, you borrow shares and deliver those for settlement.
Okay.
Okay, that's a short sale.
Got it.
A naked short sale is that you mark your trade short, you sell the shares, and you don't show up at settlement. Okay, so you don't do the borrow.
Okay, nobody else has taken my position. I'm showing up without...
Well, here's the thing. If somebody buys, every short sell has a buyer.
Right.
Okay, every sell has a buyer, or it doesn't settle.
When I said buy, I meant I bought my short position is what I meant.
You mean you borrowed shares.
Yeah, I know it's all you stock guys got terminology. I just, you know, in my head, I get it, you know, but you got to use the right words or you guys all freak out. Okay.
Because here's the thing is that.
No, you're right. We got it. That's why I want you here is to help us understand the terminology here because they'll fling this by at congressional hearings and on television, CNBC, a bunch of liars. And they keep going, you know, on and on. And we were like, what the heck are they talking about? Okay.
Right.
So now I want to understand this one point before we go into this break. What I need to know is when you say that I don't incur these costs, I want to understand what cost and how do I not incur them by doing this a certain way? Go ahead and explain that for me.
Okay. So in a short sell, you have to borrow the shares.
Okay.
Before settlement comes. So when you borrow the shares, you have to pay somebody a fee to find them and to locate the shares for you, and then you have to pay a percentage over the period of time that the shares are on loan.
Okay.
So it's kind of like borrowing money, right? There's a bank charges you a fee for the loan, and then they charge you interest on it, kind of like that, except you're borrowing stock.
Got it.
Okay. In a fail to deliver, you avoid the fee and the percentage because you simply sell the shares and then just don't show up at settlement. And the system allows that and just marks it, you know, makes a note and says, okay, you failed to deliver. You owe us some shares whenever you get around to it.
Wow.
Well,
we're going to clear this up even more when we come back on Declare Your Independence with Suzanne Trimbath. We'll be right back.
Freedom's the answer. What's the question? You're listening to Ernest Hancock.
Welcome back to Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, my very special guest, Suzanne Trimbath, PhD, from New York University, teaching economics and finance because she lived it. She saw it. It changed. It altered. It went back and forth. And now I want to, you know, focus on what we were just talking about, Suzanne, the fail to deliver. Okay, so I'm instead of actually, you know, reconciling, I borrowed a stock that I'm selling short, and I went over here and I didn't actually get it. Somebody's failing to deliver. Okay, now tell me who's failing to deliver: the person that actually made the short or the brokerage that he was getting it from.
That's actually a very good question because
I thought
the reason that I can't give an answer for it is because that's information that's not being released to the public. When the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Depository Trust Company release information about how about fails to deliver or naked short selling, they only tell you what company whose shares were failed. And how many. They don't tell you who failed to deliver. And between you and me, that's the one piece of information that I think investors need to have.
Yeah, I mean, I don't care what the actual stock was or the money that's sitting in the bank. You know, how many they go, look, they failed to deliver this stack of cash to somebody. To who? I don't know.
I want to know if my broker is failing to deliver shares, then I want to know that because I don't want to do business with somebody like that.
Wow. Okay, now why would they keep this information?
Not being released.
Why? Why would they not release that? I mean, you'd think this would be basic information.
Well, remember, who owns the depository?
Is?
The banks and brokers.
Banks and brokers! Okay, so we got more centrally planned goodies by the bad guys that's running everything. Okay,
right.
I get it. Okay.
And there's another really important point that I want to make right at this juncture. And that is that fails to deliver, naked short selling, we're talking about what the seller does, right?
Mm-hmm.
But every one of these trades has a buyer on the other side. And that buyer is not notified that they are the recipient of a fail. So in their investor accounts, right, let's say that you bought 100 shares of IBM, and that happened to be the 100 shares that failed to deliver or was naked short sold, right?
Uh-huh.
So there's no shares there, but your broker is going to put a marker in your account called an entitlement that says that, yes, you have the shares. They'll take the money out of your account. They'll give you this, quote, entitlement, this little electronic IOU that says that we'll get you the shares someday. But they don't tell you that those shares don't exist.
Oh.
At this point in time, there are now more people think they own more shares than exist.
Okay, now this is one thing that we're building up to this. I don't know if now's a good time to cut to it, but it gives us a better understanding. You have all of these shares that are out there, and somebody thinks that they own them, okay? Mm-hmm. This is mine. You put it in a central pile that's the depository trust, and they're sitting there going, okay, here's your pile. Now, what you're talking about is somewhere, somehow, electronically, there are more claims to that than that 100 shares that are sitting there. There's more than 100 claims to that 100 shares.
That's correct.
Now, when they finally, somebody, somewhere, is going, we got to reconcile this. We got to, you know, and then how do you decide whose claim is valid, who has the more valid claim, who gets it and who doesn't? How do you decide? Let me tell you what I know. I guarantee the banks will get it, to get theirs first. This is what I know, okay? Now, who does that process? How is that going to be reconciled? When? Because sooner or later, there's going to be an audit. There's going to be some, sooner or later, somebody's going to say, man, we got to balance the books on this. In fact, that's why they're starting to create, you know, they already did it in Europe. They're starting to create this Marquette thing or something. We're going to reconcile it, all right? When we come back, we'll talk. This is only about a minute break, so we'll be right back. It won't take that long, but I want to make sure when we come back, you're going to have claims to the stocks that are sitting there in some pile somewhere. There's claims to that more than what exist. When it finally all comes crashing down, whose claim is going to be recognized? This is how the bank robbery is going to happen.